got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you, as always. What's up, Kevin?
Oh, nothing terribly new. Starting an exciting year of teaching at the university, and I'm doing this almost 100% online, which has its challenges, but this is 100% online and works okay.
Yeah, it works pretty darn good, I'd say. So you're not going to do the thing where you have like a glass shield between you and your students like I've been seeing at some schools?
I will with some. I do have some that wish to do it in person, and I can't blame them. It's upper-level molecular biology, and it's really hard to teach that over online, and we'll do it. But I think some students will benefit from the in-person attention, which is great. But everybody will get attention, just a little different learning experience online, and we'll make it happen.
Very good. Well, I'm excited for all your students. And in the meantime, let's dive into some science news. So first up, we've got a pair of celebrities who are promoting a new brand of quote unquote clean wine, and they're using some long debunked claims about organic farming to do it. So we're going to explain what's going on there. Next up, the FDA has delayed a game changing therapy for hemophilia. And it's really shocked doctors and scientists who are familiar with the drug, and it's a gene therapy more specifically. So they're shocked about that. So we're going to explain that as well. And then finally, a new study helps explain why flu vaccines don't provide long-lasting immunity, and the findings also could help us develop a universal vaccine for seasonal flu one day. But first up, Kevin, let's talk about Cameron Diaz and Catherine Power, who I was not familiar with before this, but apparently they've got this clean wine that they're trying to pitch everybody.
Oh, I did the same thing. I had to figure out who Catherine Power was, and she's an American fashion entrepreneur, I found out. And then I started thinking about it, and I wasn't quite sure who Cameron Diaz was either. And then it hit me that she was from Something About Mary, and that was 1998, 22 years ago.
Dang, man, I'm old. I'm getting so old.
I know, and it was a really good movie, and it's an old one now. But anyway, I was thinking about this clean wine thing, and I really started to look into this because it's not just them. They have what they are considering to be a clean wine, but the problem is you can claim to make, and this is the article that this comes from, is by Hugh Jones, who was published originally in Harper's in the UK. Problem is, wine doesn't require you to list any ingredients on the label, and that there are a lot of ingredients in wine and a lot of processes for clarification, for removing tannins, and all kinds of goodies that are added that are still there in trace amounts, that would probably freak people out. But they say this is chemical-free wine, which, think about that for a minute. They say it's chemical-free wine, that it's clean wine, and since you don't have to put things on the label, then it allows them to make that claim with zero transparency. And so that's why this is so objectionable.
So this is not a hot take by any means, but we do need to point this out. And you sort of alluded to it, but of course, wine is alcohol, and alcohol is a known carcinogen. And so that just needs to be set up as the background, that these people are, I would call it vanity, frankly, but they're trying to take pride in the fact that this is a clean wine, and maybe it's natural and it's better for you, whatever, but it's alcohol. It'll get you drunk. If you drink enough of it, it can give you cancer and cause some other nasty side effects. So just to put that in perspective for everybody.
Oh, you're precisely right. It is 13 million parts per billion of a known carcinogen, you know, of ethanol. And, you know, I'm not against alcohol at all. I think it's wonderful stuff, you know, when used correctly, but it's one of these things that they attribute risk to other chemistries, you know, like the hints of maybe, you know, the pesticides that are used in the field, like fungicides, which every grape orchard, every grape vineyard uses, every single one of them, except for muscadines, every single grape uses some sort of fungicide protection. And that, you know, they downplay that as, well, this is clean wine, it's only from organic grapes. But organic grapes use fungicides, lots of fungicide. You're using copper and sulfur and all kinds of other natural compounds that, even though they're natural, they are toxic. They do have environmental impacts. And especially in California, well, up by you, when you see, I don't know if you've ever been out in an organic wine country during the summer, but there is significant use of sulfur that the fields look yellow from all the sulfur they use. So there are chemicals used in wine production, period.
I wouldn't scaremonger about this, but I have read reports of people that go out into wine country during that time, and they actually have reported getting sick from exposure to some of these chemicals. I think it was copper in the example I was thinking of. But all that to say, you know, chemicals are widespread and we need them. And we've talked about that plenty on the show. I don't want to regurgitate that, but this is a quote from the story I wanted to get to, and it underscores the hypocrisy that I was getting at. But he says, they rail against additives in wine, which is probably why they fail to list the additives that they use. If you want to lead a movement championing transparency, don't be opaque. And so I think that's so amusing, because they're using all of these things that they're criticizing. And I don't understand how you can go about that. Is it just, what do you think, Kevin? Is it blindness, or I don't understand?
Well, it's the hypocrisy of having it both ways, right? It's, you can say we make a clean product, but we're not going to tell you what's in it. And this is, it's all about sales. There's another company that does this clean wine thing called Scout and Seller. And they say that 68% of consumers will pay more for products if they have ingredients that are perceived as clean. Meaning, saying your opponent or your competition is dirty means they'll pay more for yours. And so it's a good way to kind of throw your competition under the bus implicitly. And the guy, there's another interesting wine company that does this called Wink Wines, W-I-N-C. And when they talk about their wines, they, you know, their slogan is wellness without deprivation. Okay, so where you're not giving up anything to have good wine. But this guy even says on their websites, they don't manipulate their wines. And when you start thinking about this, don't manipulate wines. Wine is a manipulated product. You don't go to the stream and that's flowing wine over the waterfall. It is such a processed product by every definition. You're taking grapes, you're squeezing the stuff out of them, you're fermenting it with yeast, you're putting it in barrels of specific types. This is an art form. You know, it really is. And there's all kinds of other things that you're added to retard spoilage, to serve as antioxidants, to remove tannins, and there's all kinds of processes and clarification and fining and all the other things they do to fix wine. Viticulture is a really cool manipulation. So instead of going and standing on the idea of this is a really cool process that we do that families have been doing for hundreds of years, here's our product, they create this artificial nomenclature around we have something clean. And it just, you know, it's not exactly, you know, putting a jade egg in your yoni, but it's of similar craziness.
And I don't want to dwell on this, but just because I like throwing sand in people's eyes, aren't wine grapes a great example of the monocropping or monoculture that people always complain about?
Oh, totally. I mean, that is so, they are the biggest monoculture you can imagine, because they've been the same for forever and genetically narrow. And
we talked about that a few weeks ago, actually.
Yeah. And it's also the hypocrisy of the industry in France was saved because of rootstocks from North America. So here you're creating something that never could have existed in nature. A real Frankenstein of a plant, right? Bottoms and tops don't match. But that's perfectly fine. And then just let me throw in a couple other goodies I found online with about this clean wine thing. They'll say I think it was the Wink Wine that said, is it non-GMO? And they say that that the grapes have been certified by the California Certification of Organic something or CCOF. I can't remember what it stands for, but they're certified not to contain genetically modified organisms. And I hope they paid about $20,000 for the certification.
And the reason that's funny, and Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure there isn't a commercialized transgenic grape or a gene edited grape. They're in development, but because the industry is so resistant to scaring away its customer base, no grapes are GMO. And this is real common in food production, but that's just amusing. I think I have that correct.
That's exactly right. Yeah. No, there's never been the release of a genetically engineered grape. And we've actually had them made down here in Florida, where one of the big diseases in grapes is Pierce's disease. And they made grapes that resist Pierce's disease. And a really sharp guy named Dr. Dennis Gray was the guy who did this years ago. And they ended up being autoclaved a couple of years ago because the industry says it was a non-starter. So here you had a genetically engineered grape that had a little protein in it that would defeat the bacteria that could have had a wine industry in Florida, which California in drought would have been a good thing, and something that would have resisted Pierce's disease, which is spread by an insect that's everywhere in California. So it would be good, but you know, spray the insecticides instead. So another step going the wrong direction.
Well, it is what it is. I guess people will cling to certain ideas. I guess we'll just have to keep yelling at them like grouchy old men, Kevin. But let's talk about this new gene therapy. This is a surprising story, frankly. I'm not sure what to make of it. So what's going on with this?
Well, you're talking about valoctocogene roxaparvovec,
BPN. Is that a dinosaur?
Either that or like a Romanian soccer player. this is a drug, also called BMN-270 for short. This has been on my radar for a while, and you know, full disclosure, I'm a shareholder in the company that does this. But the bottom line is, this is about hemophilia A, and hemophilia A is a deficiency in something called factor 8. And factor 8 is one of many blood clotting factors. And blood clotting is this amazingly complicated process. Because think about it. You want the blood to clot when it's supposed to clot, but you sure don't want it to clot when it's not supposed to, right? I mean, this is the stuff of heart attacks and strokes, and when you have clotting that's inappropriate. Thrombus, you know, thrombal disorders anyway, the name escapes me. Anyway, the bottom line is clots, you don't want clots when clots are not supposed to happen. So it's a very active feedback, interlaced series of these clotting factors that talk to each other and make the appropriate response to a wound. And people who are lacking factor 8, they have a problem with clotting. And it's a very rare disease. It's quite rare. It's on the X chromosome, so it's mostly males that have it. It's most common in males. And you can have it to different levels. There are different mutations that happen, so many of them spontaneous. It's a really interesting set of genetics. But you can have very mild forms where you just bleed a little longer if you have a tooth pulled, or you know, you have other problems, and you may not even notice it. But then other people have more severe types of this disease, where they bleed in their joints or in their muscles just from motion. And to have this corrected, they have to have factor 8 infusions. And so you get between 100, 150 factor 8 infusions a year. And to treat someone with factor 8 for a lifetime is something like $25 million. And it's changed a lot over the years. They used to get factor 8 from blood plasma, but now they get 75% of it from recombinant protein they produce in bacteria. It's super cool. So anyway, the whole story about about gene therapy was really has been done for a while with respect to hemophilia. And it was originally done by, I think, Chiron Corporation. It was a company back in the 90s, and they had a good hemophilia gene therapy, and it worked. just didn't work very well. So it would give people some level of factor 8 increase in their blood. The new story is about BioMarin, and they, after years of research on this and using a different kind of viral delivery, they put in an application to do this a couple of years ago, and all of the data were looking really good. Even in 2017, they had a paper come out that showed really good benefit, and that people who were on high doses of the virus, it was working, and that they didn't have these joint bleeds that were common. And so far, everything was looking great. And really, that's the setup for the whole story.
And just so I'm clear, just so everyone else is clear, so they give the patient a working version of the gene that produces this clotting factor. Is that, that's to sum it up in simple terms?
That's right. You give the an adenovirus that can deliver, that carries the correct sequence of the human factor, a clotting factor, and it finds its way into the liver and where these are produced and works inside those cells. So you actually get an infection with the correct, with a virus carrying the correct type of gene, which then is expressed in the body producing factor 8. And now that factor 8 exists, and now you can clot. And it worked. And the idea was is that if you could give somebody this gene therapy, you would do this one time rather than have to have somebody coming back constantly for, every several times a week for a IV of new clotting factor. And the advantage to this, of course, is that the cost is much lower, only $3 million for one dose. but that was the main idea. And I believe the basis for the rejection, which was very recent, was that it didn't seem to be sustaining as long as they thought it would.
Okay. So, and I'm struggling with what to think about this, because I've expressed some skepticism about certain gene editing therapies on this show, or at least the implications later on down the line. But even from my vantage point as maybe someone who's a little more conservative about this stuff, I don't see why this should have been held up. And I could be missing something because I'm not an expert, but even if it isn't a one-time treatment, maybe it works for 5 years or 10 years, and then people still have access to those pre-existing therapies. So to follow up what we were talking about last week, where we were talking about, well, people could try drugs like this as long as they're being overseen by experts and it's a properly designed clinical trial. I think all those qualifications are met here, right? So, am I off base here? I just feel like maybe the FDA is being a little too cautious.
Well, it's hard to say exactly what's happening with the FDA. There are other drugs that are available that work on this to some degree, and other therapeutics that are in the pipelines. There are many competing gene therapy strategies. So maybe they didn't want to get too far over their skis with respect to approving one that would be able to do this when there are so many other possibilities out there. It's hard for me to speculate on, but the bottom line is you have a part of the problem, I think, is rare diseases don't get a lot of funding and they don't have a huge potential for profit. You spend a lot of money on getting something deregulated when there's only 20,000 people in the U.S. that have hemophilia A. And so how do you justify so much resource going into a problem, the research for probably never really making a profit on the drug? And so this is probably part of it too. It's really hard to say where this all balances.
Yeah, and you're right, it is speculation. We can't know for sure. But it seems that if this happens, then it disincentivizes people for all the reasons you just said. But these drug companies get skittish about, getting an approval. And I think all of the indications were good. Everyone was expecting, as I said in the introduction, everyone was expecting the FDA to greenlight this. And then all of a sudden they said, well, we need another, I think it was a year or 2 years of data on the patients that are in this clinical trial before we give this the go ahead. But
that's right. Know. Yeah. They didn't reject it, right? They didn't say no. Right. They just said, we got to put this off. And that can make some sense. They didn't start a formal phase three trial on this drug. They extended phase one, two trials. And so the studies that were working for safety, they just continued to examine for efficacy and saw it. So it could be that they're just looking to get sufficient data to be able to make the best decision with respect to this. Because, you know, when everyone's waiting, when there are a lot of people out there waiting for these technologies to fail, in a way, some good due diligence is a really positive thing. So hoping that the people in the trials are doing well and hope more people have access to the therapy, let's cross our fingers and hope it comes out.
Well, fingers crossed. But let's talk about flu vaccines. I thought this story was actually really, really cool. But give us an intro to the science on this.
Yeah. So why do flu vaccines fail? You know, why is it that I shouldn't say that? Why is it that they lose their? I know. I'm gonna get a like from Robert Kennedy Jr.
Breaking: Kevin Fulta says flu vaccines fail.
I kind of like this guy. Yeah. The bottom line is that flu vaccines provide only temporary efficacy. And every year we have to have a new shot based upon the strain of flu, which is being present in repositories that are present in China typically. And you can guess what's going to happen by what's circulating in the birds and people over there. So this really was triggered by a paper in Science, where they started to look at one of the reasons why they lose their efficacy with time. So one of the reasons, and not to, you know, go on a tangent here, but one of the reasons that they are different is because, or they lose their potency, is because of what's called an antigenic shift. So this is where viruses recombine with each other and themselves, and you have pieces of the virus shuffle between within themselves, right? But there are only a couple of genes, like 8 genes in a virus, in an influenza virus, and they shuffle around. And that's why you have an H1N1, H1N5, H meaning this thing called hemagglutinin and N neuraminidase. These two different proteins are always different and can provide a different antigenic signature. So a different profile to the body as to what would be something foreign. To have an antibody against. And when they have these antigenic shifts, you could guess that the vast majority are probably deleterious to the virus. And most of them are probably neutral. But once in a while, you get one that makes it maybe a little more infectious or makes it a little better, and that these now evade the body's surveillance for the flu virus. So this is why we have to get a different one every year. Now, the other reason, and this is what's covered in the Science paper, is that when you look at the bodies, the cells that produce the antibodies in the bone marrow, that these actually decrease in numbers after the vaccine. So the vaccine gives them a big spike, they produce those antibodies, and then they kind of go away. And that was something that we didn't realize before, and that only when researchers were looking at the bone marrow after vaccination, they would show that the newly generated cells were lost within a year.
Now, do they know why? Because I read through the Science paper as carefully as I could, and I didn't see a clear answer, but maybe it was lost on me in the technical jargon. But is there some interaction between the natural immunity that some people have to the flu virus compared to the response that you get from the vaccine? Do they somehow cancel each other out, or am I just totally making that up?
Your guess is as good as mine. You know, maybe we can talk to someone who is an expert on that, because really the immune system is one of these things, like we talked about with clotting. You're working on a razor's edge. You have to have immunity against a foreign invader, but you can't have yourself being recognized as problematic. And, you know, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, so many different diseases where the body works against its own proteins, you know, MS. And so there's a very fine line to walk there. And there's probably surveillance systems in the body that maintain the levels of immune-producing, antibody-producing cells. And this may be another level of control and regulation to make sure that those cells aren't doing something stupid in the absence of an antigen. That may be, you know, again, speculation on my behalf and probably a hypothesis that many are testing. But at least inside this study, it was saying that when you looked at the bone marrow from healthy volunteers, you would see the amount of cells go up after vaccination, usually about double. But then it would slowly start to come down after a few months and was at the baseline after, you know, after a year.
Now, they said this gets us a little bit closer, possibly, I should say, to a universal vaccine or a long-lasting flu vaccine. Is that anywhere on the horizon, or are they speculating, or, you know, we're one step closer, but we still don't really have a timeline?
Well, there's dozens of ways that they're trying to do that. And there's multiple groups that are looking at a universal vaccine, mostly by targeting parts of the virus that seem to be non-variant. And you can look at the influenza A virus and find places that typically have less variation, and testing the antigenic signatures that region of the virus can give. That work is being done. I've actually interviewed Dr. Peter Pallese on my podcast about that a few months ago. But the main thing that they learned from this is that when you see that level come back down, that level never goes to zero. It still is there. And that we always maintain some level that's there. And maybe the trick to a universal vaccine is getting that level up and doing so without it having collateral consequences in promiscuous immune responses in the body. That's my guess.
Well, you're the geneticist, so you probably are guessing better than me. I noticed they say that this phenomenon affects other vaccines as well. It's just not as dramatic. So I think they brought up the measles vaccine and a couple others. Do you have any idea why the immunity from the flu vaccine goes down so quickly compared to one of these other childhood vaccines that we get?
I don't know, but I think it's really interesting because some of them are extremely durable. You know, you get the measles vaccine, it kind of works for life. You know, you never hear of somebody who's old getting stricken with measles. But look at something like chickenpox. You get chickenpox as a kid. You know, back when I got it, we didn't have vaccine. We would get the chickenpox, and now I have to go get it immunized for shingles if I get any older. You know, that is basically an immunization against herpes zoster, which is the virus that causes shingles and chickenpox. So you do have to have that immune boost that happens. And, you know, we've seen this with many different diseases or many different immunizations, different therapies. It unfortunately gives fuel to the anti-vaxxers who say, you know, well, look, it doesn't last forever like you say it does. And it does say we need to learn more about the immune system and how these things work, which, you know, that opens that door for people to start raising skepticism in comments because we don't have all the answers. And we're the first to admit that. Good thing they have all the answers.
Well, they have some answer. I don't know if it's the answer. So we'll leave that alone for this week, though. I think we beat up on the anti-vax people enough as it is. But tell us about Talking Biotech, Kevin. What do you have going on over there?
Well, the last one was about the mosquito release in the Keys. So there's cases of dengue here in the States, and Florida being the tip of the spear to mosquito-borne disease in the United States. It's critical for us to have strategies to mitigate those early as they arise. And the OxyTech company has been coming up with a strategy for years, and they have they've received approval to release mosquitoes in the state of Florida that are genetically engineered. And you can think of the heads that are exploding with that. but at the same time, it works. And it's a really neat technology. And I spoke with someone from their company who speaks like a human being about it, and she was wonderful. So worth a good listen.
Yep, absolutely. Go check it out as always. And if you want to connect with us on Twitter, it's at CamJEnglish, at Kevin Folta, geneticliteracyproject.org, and we will see you guys next time.